This is the latest episode of Fish Bites. I am your host, Danny Martinez, and as always, it's a pleasure to have you on with me. I know everyone says that when you log into a radio show and you click play on a podcast, but if you've gotten to know me, you know that I genuinely mean it. I love this fan base. I appreciate and I love this organization, and whether it's in agreement or in disagreement, I am genuinely humbled and honored and happy that you are listening and that we get to have this conversation together. Now, today we have two fun conversation pieces. One is based off of an article that I wrote that received a lot of publicity, not just from Fish Stripes, but from members in the Miami media, from members in the Miami Marlins media, a lot of feedback that was sent my way, which were the top 10 myths that Marlins fans are tired of hearing. If you want to read the article, because I'm going to go through this portion of the conversation piece very quickly, make sure to log in to fishstripes.com. As soon as you log in, you could search for top 10 myths and my piece will come up, or you could go to the masthead, click under my name, and you'll see the piece listed with all the other pieces that I've conducted. But I got a lot of good feedback from this, and a few individuals said they wanted to hear my voice, not just my writing with it. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but that will be the vast minority of this conversation. Because the reality is that those of you that have listened and have read that have already received this content. The flip side of this is the second piece, which I'm really excited for because, number one, it's a different tone than you might be used to from me. And number two, it's something that a good amount of individuals have requested. So if I'm giving you the top 10 myths Marlins fans are tired of hearing, I'm also going to give you the 10 things I would have done differently in this rebuild. Now, when I get to it, I'm going to express it. Listen, it's a disclosure full of hindsight, full of me playing the results, full of me having all of the data already looking back and then saying, what would we have done differently? In this, there are some things that I'll mention that I critiqued while it was happening. So I critiqued it back then and I'm critiquing it now. There are some things which I will own up to. I praised while it was happening. And now after further assessment, it's clearly something that should have been done differently. And then there are some elements of the rebuild that I simply did not have a point of view or perspective on while it was happening. I was neutral, or there was not enough information for me to say, oh, I support this. I don't support this from the outside looking in. But after a year or 6 months or even a month, if we're going to talk about the deadline, I feel comfortable making an assessment. So those are the two conversations for today. Top 10 things that Marlins fans are tired of hearing, myths, and top 10 things that I would have done differently in this rebuild. As always, you know the way I dance. We're going to finish with the pitching performance of the week, and we're going to talk a little bit about the hitters. But let's get right into it. Top 10 myths received a lot of really good feedback. It was an article that I did extensive research on. Some legal parameters. I was able to discuss some of the things that I was uncertain with individuals around the Marlins organizations, getting feedback from fans, things of they're tired of hearing that are just myths, right? And Eli Sussman is the managing editor of Fish Stripes. He's also the individual that does my leading lines or narratives under our titles. And he wrote it perfectly. He says, it is easy to punch down at the Marlins after so many years of losing and controversy, but at least do it honestly. Let's put a stop to the misinformation and stale narratives. I agree with that. I mean, listen, that's why I said a few weeks ago, if you're a diehard Marlins fan, you are amongst the best in baseball because no one is faking this. There have been more than enough things and circumstances, tragedies, and things that they've caused upon themselves that should be pointed out and difficult to taste and difficult to stick with the Marlins. But then that leads to us also getting frustrated when things that are simply inaccurate, simply untrue, are then also put on top of their graves and put on top of the ridicule that we get as a fan base. So what are the top 10 things that Marlins fans are tired of hearing? I hope you hear me out here and you let me know if there's something you agree with or disagree with. A lot of comments on this on the reply section. So jump on there and leave comments as well. Number one, and these aren't really ordered, but really this might be the number one for me. the Marlins are going to leave Miami. I won't go too far into this myth because I've discussed it here on air with you. No, right? I got my hands on the legal documents. No, the Marlins aren't going to be leaving the city of Miami anytime soon. The first time that that could even happen legally is 2047. David Sampson, the ex-president of the Marlins, confirmed this via Twitter, via his verified Twitter account. He basically backed up the work and the findings that I put out. The Miami Marlins are not leaving Miami. Get over it if you think that that's what's going to happen. I am someone who loves the University of Miami. I love all teams in Miami. A lot of times, the individuals that say, oh, they just need to get out, are actually Hurricane alumni, are individuals that still have that resonating love with the Orange Bowl. I often say, listen, if we have an issue with that, we should have had an issue with the administration that could not get renovations and could not keep the Orange Bowl up or find their own location. Now they're at the Hard Rock and that's perfectly fine, but I'm not going to blast the Marlins for taking advantage of the inadequacies of another organization that was not allowed and not permitted to continue where they wanted to be or to find their own spot. So for any of those that continue saying the Marlins are going to leave Miami, it's simply legally wrong, it's objectively incorrect, and maybe when I'm in my 50s and 60s, it might happen if success hasn't come down here, if, you know, the organization and the ownerships keep flip-flopping, maybe. But until 2047, and even after an option after that, it's not going to happen. Number two, attendance is even worse than before. Incorrect. Okay, we've discussed this as well. The Marlins have a very different fashion of recording and sending out information of how many butts were in the chairs at each Marlins game. Doubled the amount is what was usually reported because of the way that Loria, and not just Loria, many ownership groups around all professional, not just baseball, all professional sports, inflate their numbers. This is, again, directly from Forbes. The first myth comes directly from the legal paperwork in the city of Miami. The second myth comes directly from one of the most respected business and organization analysis websites and magazines. Forbes, quote, reported attendance for the Marlins was off 51%, but paid attendance was roughly flat, as the team did away with inflating attendance figures that often doubled the actual ticket sales. I added, is attendance good? Of course not. But reality is that it has not changed much from prior figures, and I stand by that. Matter of fact, this year, from using the counting that they also used last year, they're a little above pace from last year, which is incredibly impressive. Now, it's not by a lot. It's by less, maybe even 100,000 or 10,000 or 20,000. I'm not even sure what the number is. It's very small, but it's impressive when you recall that the New York Yankees played here last year, but not this year. That the Red Sox played here last year, but not this year. You know, the University of Miami night was fantastic. It was the most attended game, even above opening day. But one single game of getting to 30,000 does not change and does not compensate for the six games that you lost of last year with the Yankees and the Red Sox, as well as other marquee games that the Marlins have simply not had this year. So attendance is what attendance is. There's no surprise to this. The Marlins, whether it was the Florida Marlins in Pro Player or Joe Robbie or Landshark or Dolphin Stadium, and the Miami Marlins, any year that's not 2012 at Marlins Park, are going to have attendance issues the same way that any other team in Miami will have attendance issues, aside from the Dolphins, because they only play X amount of games here, and because they have a large, large contingency of fans from the opposing team that always come in. I know, I'm a season ticket holder for the Fins. Except from the Dolphins, they're going to have issues if they're not winning and if they're not winning consistently. I bring up a point later on in a second, actually, myth three, so we'll get to it, that Miami will never support baseball. That's the myth. Now, understandably, this is very subjective. They might not, but there is precedent for it. How I just said that there's no franchise that can sustain attendance if they're not winning correctly. Most individuals will say, oh, Danny, there's this team down in Biscayne, and they sell out every single game, even after number six left. Yeah, I agree. Just like with the Dolphins, I am at most AAA games. I understand that. I also remember 2002, and I remember 2003, and 2004, and 2005, when the Miami Heat weren't very good, except for 2005. They weren't very good at all. And in a 29-team NBA league, they ranked 24th, 22nd, 19th. And then all of a sudden, Shaq comes and boom, they're fourth. Why? Because Miami only comes and only shows up. It's not to say that they're not fans. It's not to say that we're not diehards. They show up when they give us a reason to. So the myth number three, Miami will never support baseball, is based off of the fact that in 2004, I could have said the same thing about the Heat. And I could have said the same thing about basketball. I could say the same thing all the time about hockey, and I understand. This year, I think the Cats are making it to the playoffs, and it's going to be exciting for us in Sunrise. I could say the same thing about the Dolphins. Listen, the Dolphins have a legacy of 40 years. That's why people still show up. Dolphins haven't given Miami a lot of reason to fill out the stadium. I am there every Sunday that there is a home game. So when I say I am aware of the 30% to 70% split of our opposing sideline being filled with purple for the Ravens or with blue and red for the Patriots or with that disgusting green for the Jets, I am aware that this is what happens. Miami has a lot of transplant fans. I get that. Miami has a lot of individuals that come over later in their life and retire here and they still support their team. I get that. But when Miami wins, all of a sudden, when it was the playoffs against the Ravens, there wasn't a lot of purple in that stadium. It was all aqua and orange. This is what happens. When Miami wins, people come out. Myth number three, Miami will never support baseball. I call baloney. Myth number four, they didn't have to rebuild. They were only two pitchers away. I mean, look, you know my perspective on this. No, a team that averaged 75 wins was not two pitchers away. That core never got to 500. And for the love of everything that is beautiful, which two pitchers would take the 75-win team with a dead last farm system in baseball to World Series contention within 2 to 3 years? You let me know. You let me know because no one ever does. I have yet to receive an email saying, hey, these are the two, even with hindsight, where Mikolas would probably be one of the best options for that offseason, who was coming from overseas. No one would have said to sign him at that point. Even with hindsight, there is not any pair of two pitchers that was going to take this team, other than the ones that Laurie had traded away, a Williams, a Castillo, a Desclafani, a Hedman, to World Series contention. Myth number five, they didn't get anything for their trades. This is my favorite one, right? Their trades, I'm talking about the rebuilding trades, the majority of trades that were sent away. The big core, right? Christian Yelich, Giancarlo Stanton, Marcelo Ozuna, D. Gordon, and JT Realmuto. Okay. Through their rebuilding trades, the Marlins received eight players with top 100 prospect pedigree, and they flipped one that wasn't top 100 in Zach Gallen for a top 100 in Jazz Chisholm. The names of the players that were all top 100 pedigree, Sixto Sanchez, Isan Diaz, Monte Harrison, George Guzman, George Alfaro, Sandy Alcantara, Nick Nieder, Lewis Brinson, Magner Sierra was on one, but he wasn't a consensus. And then, of course, Zach Gallen was on one before he was traded away for another one in Jazz Chisholm. So listen, did they attack too many high-end superstar traits and not safe prospects, which is one of the things that I would say we would have done differently in this rebuild? Absolutely. And we're going to talk about that later on. But to say that they did not get talent back, whether it was prospect talent or not, is a fallacy and it is just simply incorrect. If they had not gotten talent back, they would not currently be number four in Fangraph's farm system, number four in MLB.com's farm system rankings, and I believe either number seven or number eight in Baseball America's rankings. That simply would not be the case, especially when you understand that they didn't have to go from 15 to 4 or 20 to 4 or 25 to 4. They had to go from dead last to 4 in 1.75 years. Let's please stop pretending they did not get anything for these trades.
From day one when we got here, we said that we had a plan and we're going to stick to that plan. And it all starts with making sure that we have a good minor league system and good scouting department, good player development, good analytics. And, you know, for us in a short period of time, you know, 2 years is a short period of time, even though it feels like it's been 20. But in a short period of time now to get that validation from outside sources makes you feel good. But at the same time, we still have a long, long way to go.
Myth number six is really me just being a little bit picky on semantics, but quote unquote, two MVPs were traded away. No. One MVP was traded away who has had his issues, who many Yankee fans are regretting bringing on, but is a phenomenal player whenever he is healthy in his own right. Absolutely. Giancarlo Mike Stanton was the one MVP that was traded away. Now, I understand. I grasp it. People talk about the second MVP because Christian Yelich goes on to Miller Park and the NL Central and all of a sudden can reproduce his home run total in 1.5 years that he had 4 years to do in Marlins Park. And suddenly he is now an MVP. Listen, as Craig Mish reported, and as I will continue to say, two offers were made for Christian Yelich: Toronto Blue Jays, Milwaukee Brewers. You would think that if Christian Yelich was an MVP, more teams would have offered something substantial to get an MVP on their roster. The reason that there wasn't is because he wasn't one. He was a very good player who unlocked and became much better, not just because of ballpark factors, but definitely helping with ballpark factors when he went to Milwaukee. Good for him. I'm tired of people, you know, wishing the worst for him or not wanting him to succeed. Fine. You know, I'm going to talk about it in a second. One of the things they shouldn't have done is appeased his tantrum and his public demands for a trade, whether they were justified or not. But I don't root against the guy. I also just have an issue, though, when individuals just assume that, oh, yeah, he was MVP. No, he wasn't. He wasn't. No one identified it except Stern over in Milwaukee. And good for them. Good for Yelich. Good for the Brewers. But one MVP was traded away, not two. Myth number seven, can't believe all the young pitchers the Marlins had and they still rebuilt. This is the laziest one. I'm being kind of forthright today. So be it. This is the laziest one. What happened here is that the young pitchers in that quote are Luis Castillo, Domingo Germán, Chris Paddock, Desclafani, individuals like that, Williams from the Pirates. What occurred here is you might be thinking, but Danny, they weren't here in 2017 when the ownership changed. Yes, correct. You are knowledgeable, educated, well, understandably, diehard, beautiful fan. But not everyone is. So when the national media starts painting pictures of what the Marlins could have been without any trades, they include players that were traded under the Loria regime, such as Castillo, Germán, Paddock, and others. And then the individual who doesn't realize the difference between them being traded earlier and after think that they were also included in the rebuild, which is ridiculous and would make zero sense, but c'est la vie. It's the laziest narrative. It's the laziest myth. No, the Marlins did not have these young pitchers. If they did, they actually wouldn't have rebuilt. I have it on incredibly good understanding and standing that Giancarlo Stanton would have probably been the only one gone if Luis Castillo and Domingo Germán and Chris Paddock were still in this organization by the time that the new regime, the Bruce Sherman era, began. Why? Well, because, listen, Stanton's deal was always backloaded. Anyone with any inkling of financial understanding of baseball in South Florida could understand that Stanton was going to be gone before those heavy years came in on the budget. So he would have been gone. But if the errors of Loria, and I understand it, they went for it. Okay, they took a risk. If those errors were still in the system, this rebuild wouldn't have taken place the way it did. Myth number eight, Marlins ownership has no money and will never spend. Okay, I have no way of knowing if Sherman and company will ever spend heavily on player payroll. I get it. But the belief that they do not have the resources to compete with almost anyone in baseball is objectively false. Listen, we don't have all of the finances of the ownership group of the Miami Marlins. But of those that are available to us, again, I'm not even working with the full pie chart here. Of those that are available to us, the ownership group of the Marlins have a net worth over $5 billion. $5 billion. As a comparison, Jeffrey Loria was the only owner, so he would be the entire ownership group. His net worth was $500 million. $500 million to now $5 billion. I am not naive enough to think that the ownership group of the Marlins is going to use even a significant portion or fraction of that wealth and that net worth on the fish. That's not what I am saying. But even if they just use 5% or 1%, it is exponentially more than what Laura would have been able to put into the team. So when I say, and when others say, don't worry about the finances, they will spend when they need to spend, or they, better stated, they could spend when they need to spend. Take it as what it is. Now, will they is a completely different story. I feel that the Marlins have spent money already on things during the rebuild, which is going to be myth number 9. But will they really spend when Brian Anderson needs to be extended, when they have to go get a Nicholas Castellanos to add a veteran bat, or maybe a Puig to add some marketing and some offensive help, whatever the case is, or later down the line, if they want to pursue a really top archetype elite player, will they spend? I don't know. But to pretend that they can't is simply incorrect. I mentioned number 9. New ownership hasn't spent anything after the rebuild. Oh, this one's really fun too, because all you have to do is walk into the publicly funded stadium and realize that Loya never did anything to renovate it, and that the first year that they have time to do so, the new ownership has already pumped in $15+ million into the stadium to make it one of the more beautiful stadiums around. I'm trying to remember as I speak which national outlet was ranking the stadiums. But they had a, you know, they had a where they was ranked before and where it was ranked after. The Marlins gained 10, 15 spots. Absolutely. They got rid of the lime green. They got rid of the statue that many people did not necessarily love. They invested money into the renovations, into the food. They lowered season ticket prices. They've spent internationally. They're building a complex in the Dominican Republic, and they've built a bunch of parks for little kids and for children and for teenagers around the city of Miami. So to pretend that they're not spending is absurd. Interestingly enough, the other exciting thing is this. The 2019 adjusted payroll, so the payroll for this year, is around $75 million. Okay? That is only slightly lower by around $2.5 million than the adjusted payroll for 2016. Which means that in 2019, which we all are aware is a rebuilding year, the Marlins have almost the same payroll as the 2016 Loria Marlins, who were quote-unquote going for it. So for those that want to say, oh, well, they just slashed payroll all the way down, what, by $3 million? I mean, I understand it would have been a lot more if you had kept Stanton, if you had kept Yelich, if you had kept Zuna, if you had kept Gordon. I fully understand that. But people are pretending that the Marlins are putting $35 million out into the field. They're not. They're putting out the same amount of capital out in the field as the 2016, hey, we're going for it because we're such a great core and we're going to end up with 75 wins, Miami Marlins. 10th myth, and then we're going to get to the 10 things that I would do differently and I would have done differently in this rebuild. The Marlins censor local media coverage. Okay. Listen, we all loved Tommy Hutton and Rich Waltz. Really, it's part of the reason that I fell in love with the Marlins as an organization, part of the reason I fell in love with baseball as a sport. But this inflated and simply untrue belief that the Marlins can walk into another independent company like Fox Sports Florida and control their content and tell Tommy Hutton to get out and tell Rich Waltz to get out and bring whoever they is simply inaccurate to the T, confirmed through multiple sources. Now, would the Marlins say, oh yeah, we do that? Of course not. But when you also contact Fox Sports Florida and they say the same, then, I mean, come on. Do I think that they have a way to be at the table? Absolutely. Every partnership should. The Marlins and Fox Sports Florida are on a contract. They're in a partnership. They should have input in what is happening. But if you think that the Miami Marlins can terminate the contract of an employee who gets a check from an entirely different company, I don't know what to tell you, especially not in this contract. Everyone knows Fox Sports Florida has basically done at will whatever they want with the Marlins in this last contract. It is the worst TV contract, marketing contract in all of baseball, if not all of sports. So I can guarantee you that the Marlins are not walking into a room and strong-arming Fox Sports Florida executives. It's not happening. this concept that they are the ones that should be blamed or that they are the ones that should be praised for additions or terminations is just false. The same way, at a much lesser extent, I understand we're not Fox Sports Florida, but we communicate and have partnerships with the Marlins the same way that they don't control our content. The same way that I could say whatever I want. Listen, I'm going to guarantee you that the Miami Marlins didn't call me up and say, hey, you know what you should do on your next podcast, on your next on-air recording? You should do the top 10 things that you would do differently in our rebuild. I can guarantee you that that's not what happened here. They don't control content. We, of course, want to be professional. I'm sure Fox Sports Florida does as well. But for those of you that continue to bring up the Rich Waltz and the Tommy Hutton situation and some of the content control where you hear Fox Sports Florida be positive. Oh, so they're being positive because the Marlins asked them to. It's simply false. Simply false. Those are the top 10 myths Marlins fans are tired of listening to and tired of hearing. I know I'm tired of listening to them. If you want to leave a comment, if you want to discuss it a little bit more, send me an email. If not, go to fishstripes.com. Find the article, Top 10 Myths Marlins Fans Are Tired of Hearing, and make sure to leave a reply down in the comment section. So now we're going to transition into 10 things that I think I would have done differently in the rebuild. And listen, I already said it in the introduction, full of hindsight and full of playing the results. Some things I criticized, some things I praised, some things I was neutral on when it was happening. But all things that would take a good to very good rebuild at face value thus far and would have made it closer to perfection, closer to just out of the park. You hit a grand slam type of rebuild. Again, these are not ordered in any particular fashion, but they are the 10 things that I would have done differently in this rebuild. Number one, I would have been more transparent with the fan base from the initial launch of the rebuild. And now, you know, this doesn't mean that you have to declare rebuild, you know, like the way that Mike Scott did in The Office, right? I declare bankruptcy. That's not what I'm saying. I didn't need Bruce Sherman or Derek Jeter to stand up and say, this is exactly what is happening. We are going to trade Stanton, and then we are going to trade Ozuna. No, because that makes no sense. There are some fans that want that. I'm sorry. That is incredibly stupid. You know, no GM, no executive is ever going to do that. Because number one, it's disrespectful to the players that you're shipping out. And number two, it's like going to war and giving the blueprints to the opposing country. I mean, come on, this isn't something that you do. However, there are ways of saying it that are a little bit more palatable while still telling your fan base what to expect. Something as simple as, listen, we are going to follow the lineage of other successful team transformations, such as the Astros and the Cubs. They were in similar positions like us. They had not been winning for multiple decades at a time or a long period. We are going to start from the ground up. Some will come back and say, Danny, you know, Jeter kind of said that. Jeter said there would be some tough decisions. You know, Mike Hill said that we have to build this from the bottom up, from rookie ball all the way to the major league level. I understand that. But I still think that there should have been a little bit more transparency and just honesty. Like the whole, we're not going to call it a rebuild, it's a build. Okay, that's great. I mean, I don't know what marketing specialist came up with that. It's a rebuild. Like, that's what it is. It is a rebuild. It's been a really successful one. And maybe if we had just been a little bit more open and transparent about it in the beginning of it, we wouldn't have the backlash that we got. Because public relations is much better right now than it was a year ago. But holy moly, public relations was awful a year ago because there was this lack of transparency and you know, this national media perspective that ran away with dirty dealings. Oh, how they told Stanton to accept the contract and accept the trade. You're going to be stuck here. How they didn't discuss anything with Christian Yelich. Look, those are both things that have been heavily, heavily disputed from people that I would trust telling me if it was true or not true. But because they weren't transparent and they did not get ahead of it, it's still something that people believe. I think that they had to have been a lot more transparent with the fan base from the initial launch, and that town hall that I was a part of would have been a good time to do that. And instead, there was levels of honesty, but it was flirting with professional political talk. You know, the way to sidestep a question, it just would have been better to say, we're following the Astros, we're following the Cubs, give me 2-3 years and watch what I could do this organization. Number two, oh, how great would it have been if they had convinced Christian Yelich to buy into the plan? Look, we all know how this turns out, okay? Regardless of the talent of Esan Diaz and Monte Harris and Jordan Yamamoto, and what still may become of Lewis Brinson, the Yelich deal is haunting at the moment. And that's coming from someone who loves the concept of who Esan Diaz is and Monte Harrison is and who they can be, as well as Yams and Lewis, for the future of this organization. But there's simply no way around the fact that Yelich has become little Mike Trout over in Milwaukee. And that the reality is, and this is something that has been reported by the big national media, and I can confirm this, the Marlins' plan was to keep him. He was controllable. He had the contract extension at a very team-friendly deal. The plan, for like the 500th time, was to keep Christian Yelich in a Miami Marlins jersey and let him be the cornerstone moving forward. But we know that he publicly demands a trade. I often say he threw a tantrum. Even if I don't blame him for not wanting to be a part of the rebuild, he threw a tantrum. And it wasn't just at the executives. It was public through his agent. His agent saying, oh, we have a relationship that cannot be mended. I mean, come on. Really? How dramatic? How dramatic? To sound Cuban for just a second. But he did. Then the Marlins panicked. And they appeased him by fielding the offers and by trading him, something they did not do with JT Realmuto. Realmuto, at FanFest, the reports came out from Craig Mish that he was asking for a trade. But the Marlins waited. The Marlins waited an entire year, almost, to the date that that report came out by Craig Mish. And then they traded him, and they got a very good deal for him. They got a very good young catcher in George Alfaro, and they got a future ace. I mean, just any thoughts and doubts you had about him can be put away. Sixto Sanchez is destroying minor league baseball, even after his promotion. A future ace in Sixto Sanchez, and an arm that could be either a pen arm or could be someone that comes up as a fifth or fourth starter, and Will Stewart. A beautiful deal. You would have wished they could have done something like that with Christian Yelich. But my regret really isn't that. My regret really is that they did not convince him to buy into the plan. If that happens, what an entirely different outlook we would have right now on this rebuild. Because you already have your four-win player to pair with your other four-win player in Brian Anderson. It would have been a beautiful situation if they had convinced him to buy into the plan. Say, listen, I understand that Stanton's gone. I understand you're all upset about that. You have a contract. You need to show up. And this is what you're going to be rewarded with. Because in 3 years, when this farm system is top four, five in baseball, then you're really going to be able to know what competitive baseball feels like. Maybe they tried. I can't confirm that they didn't. Maybe they tried to deal with him. And that's when the agent comes out with, no, our relationship is past the point of return and past the point of mending. All right. Maybe they tried and he wasn't having it. Maybe it really was a full out tantrum. He wanted to go and he's gone. But make no mistake about it. Regret number two and what I would have tried to do differently is gone out of my way to convince Christian Yelich to buy into the plan. Number three, this is one of the moves that I actually applauded and had no issue with while it was happening. But now I look back and I think it could have been done differently. Number three is the Miami-centric promotion marketing packages that they really went with. You know, it makes sense. I mean, all of their marketing was Miami-centric. It was very geographically located and focused on Miami and its surrounding little towns and suburbs, but only Miami-Dade, to the point that individuals from Broward and Palm Beach felt like they were being excluded, to the point that individuals from Broward and Palm Beach said, all right, fine, well, I'm not making the drive down there. If all you care about is Hialeah, I'm not going to make the drive down there. Now, listen, you know, it makes sense. It made sense for the, quote, Miami, unquote, Marlins to hyper-focus on Miami. I get that. But I also think that someone probably just fed the executive some bad information there. Because the reality is that most of us are aware that a vast percentage of the fans have always been, even after Loria kind of screwed them by not going Tri-County, by just going with Miami-Dade, for the stadium location, of course, even after, continue to be Broward-located Marlins fans. I know a bunch of them because I'm right next to all of them. I mean, I get it. I get it. They went Miami-centric, but it's an issue. And I think that that's something they should have done differently. Marlins fans span all the way up to the Palm Beaches in Jupiter because of spring training, because that's where some of our older Marlins fans live. I want to live there one day too, so that's not a spite at you. It's just a truth. And a lot of individuals still are in Broward. Now, I did report this and I sent it out that they're fixing it. They are fixing this. They are now starting to roll out the same type of packages that, you know, the City Nights, so the Hialeah Nights and the Coral Gables Nights and the Coconut Grove Nights. They're starting to roll that same kind of package out in marketing for Broward-located cities and fans. They're expanding it. I believe the first round is coming soon with Pembroke Pines and Miramar. Those are Broward cities, Broward towns. They're starting to expand, and that's okay. If that was the initial plan, right? Let's start at home. Let's start in Little Havana, like right here, right next to our park. Let's walk out of our stadium and into the hotels and into the motels and into the complexes there. And let's give out flyers. We are starting like if we are a grade A1 political team. And then we're going to expand our net until we get to Broward. If that was the plan, okay, so be it. They're at Broward now. It fixes things. But I think in the beginning, they should have just simply been more inclusive. And it wasn't like they were telling people in Broward not to come to games. But when you only focus on one geographical location, I understand how another geographical location might just be a little upset and left out. So number three, the Miami-centric promotions. Number four, I would have targeted a balanced approach of safe hitting and pitching tools over superstar traits. Someone in FanGraphs wrote this, I believe a few months ago, where they were basically singing the praises of the Marlins for going for it. You know, every single trade was a give me your most volatile but possible superstar player prospect return, and I'm going to accept. Or we have examples of this littered across the first layer of trades that were made with Lewis Brinson and Monte Harrison, Eason Diaz, Sandy Alcantara, George Guzman. These are all individuals that could all be superstars if they panned out, but had questions with their hit tool or had questions with their control, while also having immense power or immense flashy skills, and then a velocity that could kick 100 with a lot of movement. We saw the same pattern over and over again. They targeted players with incredibly high ceilings, but incredibly low floors and bust ability. It's something that I would have done a little differently. Now, interesting how they course corrected this over the past deadline. Because now they combined a Jazz Chisholm, who again has that superstar trait, has that superstar ceiling, but is very volatile, with much safer hitting prospects like Alewin Diaz, who does not strike out very much, but hits for power, makes good contact, like a Jesus Sanchez, who is at the moment the bona fide best prospect in the system from a bats perspective. Sixto Sanchez is still that guy overall. But from a bats perspective, it's Jesus Sanchez, I'm telling you. Think Christian Yelich before he came up. That is who this guy can be. I'm not talking about MVP Christian Yelich hitting 40 home runs. I'm talking about Christian Yelich prior. This is who he can be. You get your Christian Yelich 2.0, your repeat. Try to buy him into the plan. But they balanced that out. We also saw this new pattern of balancing out safe with risk over the draft, right? They took the safe bet. They took, for financial reasons, because they were trying to buy and trying to overslot a lot of really high talent. But for some reasons, safe reasons, they also took a lot of college bats. They took some college arms. I mean, they took safer prospects is the case that I'm trying to get to. It's nice to see that because that was not something we saw last year. Last year, they again took the high school batter and the high school shortstop, the prep arm. They took these players that were risky again. 2018 was riskier, apparently, for the Miami Marlins. Give me all of your riskiest prospects. Give me all your riskiest draftees, and then we'll see what happens. And they course corrected this year. But that's something that I would have loved to have seen from the beginning. I would have loved to have seen that balance of for every Jazz Chisholm, we have a Jesus Sanchez and a Alewin Diaz. That pattern and that formula they did at the deadline, that should have been the pattern and formula that they did for all of their deals. For every Lewis Brinson, I want to have a Hiura from Milwaukee or a safer prospect that I'm sure is going to hit. Now, I personally believe Eason Diaz and Monte Harrison are still going to hit. And when I mean hit, I don't actually mean like bat to ball. I mean hit as in they're going to hit close to their ceilings. Like they're going to get close to their ceilings. They're going to accomplish successful careers. I genuinely believe that. It's the same guy that told you about Zach Gallen I was laughed at. Well, I'm telling you this about Esan Diaz. I believe it. I believe with Monte as well, as long as he's healthy. So I am not trying to bash on that. Sometimes you do hit with your superstar traits. I just think they needed a little bit more balance. The fifth thing that I would have done differently in this rebuild, understanding that this is all hindsight and that we're also looking back at this, is I would have completed the rebranding going into 2020 instead of going into 2019. I believe it was George who came on and had that conversation. If it wasn't, please correct me, whoever it was. But I lost my notes and I couldn't confirm it. He came on and he said something very similar where he said, I would have liked to have done the rebranding. So the different jerseys, the different colors, our colores into 2020 and not 2019. Because 2019 is still very much so a rebuilding year with a lot of losing, right? We all understand that. If you haven't grasped that by now, I feel bad for you. And it kind of taints the perspective of the rebuild. Think about it right now. Think about us right now in those same old ugly jerseys. Just my opinion, you're allowed to have a different one. And then us having the top four farm system in baseball, still having a top 15 rotation, even with all of the injuries and all of the performances lately from a Noesi who has nothing to do with the future plans of the Marlins. Eliezer Hernandez was probably a pen arm. Even with that, still a good young pitching rotation and much better talent coming up at the in the arms and in the bats. And now all of a sudden, we hear that the Marlins are also rebranding for next year. You want to talk about season tickets going up? You want to talk about retail going up? 2020 is the first year that we really should start seeing this team be close to what that previous core was, a 70-75 win team, if even better, depending on how many prospects get called up and how long their learning curve is at the major league level. Something we're seeing with Esan, but you know, quite frankly, no one should be worried with. This happens. Depending on all of those factors, the Marlins and their fan base could be relatively excited for next year from a competitive standpoint. Imagine adding a brand new, sexy, clean rebrand to that, especially if it would have been compounded and built upon the fact that they updated their stadium this year. It would have been a beautiful time. It would have been a beautiful marriage. Now, they didn't do it. They did it this year as a way to show the fans, look, we are doing something, and I'm okay with that. I'm okay with it. I just think that now in hindsight, now looking back, oh, that would have been exciting for next year if somehow it would have been a true restart, both on and off of the field. Number six, I would have sold high on bullpen pieces and arms in 2018, very much like they attempted to do in 2019. This is really self-explanatory. It's just a point. I don't really need to expand that much on it, but it just seemed like they were too conservative only at the deadline because everything else that they targeted was super volatile and super aggressive. But then at the deadline with a Barraclough, they get conservative and they hold on to him. With other arms that would have been able to be sent out, even with the Conley last year, you know, they got really conservative and they held on to these arms that were expendable. And again, this is hindsight, but imagine back-to-back deals like what we saw this year, back-to-back deadlines like what we saw this year. If they had pulled off what we saw this year, last year, okay? And then they pull it off again this year, you're talking about a perfectly executed rebuild with possibly the exception of Yelich. That would be something that we would look back at and be proud of. They didn't do it. Barraclough sticks here. Then they send him to Washington for some IFA money. He's part of the Victor Mesa situation, so that's good. But I mean, they just should have sold high, especially when you hear, which I won't even say because I don't want to ruin your day, when you hear some of the names that could have been brought back in a Kyle Barraclough deal. So number six, I wish they would have sold high on some of those pieces last year. Number seven, I'll get some feedback for this one, but it's okay. I would be so, you could highlight that SO, so bold in it, capitalize it, much more incredibly loud and proud of the changes within the community and the international market. I'm going to repeat it. I would be so incredibly loud and proud of the changes in the community and the international market, but they aren't. And I understand why, right? So here's the preface. The Marlins, the current Marlins, are doing more for the community than any other Marlin regime has done in a while. Okay? We all know the comparison here, who we're comparing. They are doing so much more internationally, and they are doing so much more in a local and charitable perspective. Like I said, building parks. I reported earlier on in the summer that they were doing things with Tropical Field and with other communities and baseball communities, and they're starting to roll out. It already has been rolling out. And no one knows about it because they're being humble and quiet and to themselves. I understand how this is a double-edged sword, per se, because if you shout out, you know, quote, look at us, look at how much we're helping everybody, unquote, it kind of takes away the authenticity, right? You're kind of saying, look at me, look at how much money we're putting into the city, look at how much money we're putting into the international market. It loses the genuine kindness, the charity aspect, the professional aspect of what you're doing. But the issue here is that they are doing it, and no one outside of those around the stadium and around the team are even aware of it. Oh, you built parks for kids in Miami to play baseball? Great. Oh, you have a new complex in the Dominican Republic. Let the skeptics know. The money you spent on the stadium, the outreach, the DMLO campaign, let people know, because trust me, the local Miami media isn't going to do the Marlins any favors. So what they do is they send out a little press release, right? I get it. Other individuals get it. And then maybe some of us report it. Maybe some of us don't. And that's it. So the Marlins, which are doing something good, I get it. They're doing something good for the community. They don't have to speak it out loud for everyone to understand. I grasp all of that. But then no one sees it because the local media is kind of tired of the Marlins, a good majority of them. Not even this Marlins, just the past Marlins. Just something that's been going on for a decade. But when all the Marlins do is send out one press release and it just goes to the press and it literally goes to the eyes of the newspaper outlets, and then nothing gets done about it or printed or reported, you're not building any kind of good faith, even though you actually are. So you're building good faith with the clubs that are there, the teams that are there, the kids that are there, the family that's there, but they're not going, they don't have the platform to speak it out to other individuals. So no one knows. And the issue here with me is, again, I am a Miami person, University of Miami, Nova Southeastern University, Miami Heat, Florida Panthers, Miami Dolphins. When Inter Miami comes out, guess who's going to be there too? Me. So when I don't see the other organizations necessarily be this humble about it, because the Dolphins will send out anything and everything that gets them good faith. The Miami Heat do the same. And the Miami Heat also has the local media for them as well. So the Miami media also does that for the Heat. These other teams aren't hiding behind a rock when they do something well. So why are the Marlins hiding behind the rock and trying to be humble with it? My number seven is be loud, man. Be loud. There is enough anger and frustration and myths, like we just discussed, about the Marlins. So you know what? When the reality is that you are doing something right, let people know. Number eight, and this is a baseball-related one. I would have been more patient with hitting prospects like Lewis Brinson and Magnair Sierra. Listen, they were both rushed by their previous teams. The Cardinals had Sierra up at a ridiculously young age. Milwaukee did the same with Lewis. But then, you know, stop the generational curse and issue here. Don't repeat that same mistake that the other clubs did, because then they were both rushed with the Marlins too. Now the Fish have, again, somewhat self-corrected. They've been a little bit more patient with guys in 2019 with their promotions, even though we've seen quite a lot, because especially on the arms, they are just killing it. So they're just forcing their hand. But especially with Lewis Brinson, the heavy marketing focus on him. Are you kidding me? This is a 22, 23, 24-year-old guy who's coming over here who got traded for a marquee player who then ends up being an MVP at another location. And all of the optics are about him. Oh, he's the centerpiece. He's the center. Oh, and we're going to call him up. Oh, and he's going to, I mean, come on. He was put in a psychologically damaging place. And then this, of course, gets compounded when the optics of him struggling get combined with the situation. So I think that the Marlins did a disservice there. I'm sure their internal individuals have adjusted that, because like I said, they've been more patient. And listen to me, and I'll say this again, second time I hit on Eason Diaz. Eason Diaz, you know, started out rough, then he got on base like 6 out of 7 games, and then he's had a little rough 2 games again. we need to give Ihsahn Diaz time. He is someone that I've discussed on Earning Their Stripes, usually has a pattern of getting promoted, struggling a bit in the beginning, and then dominating. So don't worry about Ihsahn Diaz too much, but also make an understanding that he is having good at-bats. He's going to be okay. There is a learning curve, believe it or not, for 23-year-olds to get called up to the major league. He's going to be okay. So I don't think they've rushed him. But I do think there was something to say about Magnair Sierra and about Lewis Brinson. Number nine. There was business decisions in this rebuild that gave the skeptic the proverbial low-hanging fruit to pick on some of the things that the Marlins did, like the removal of McKeon and other ex-Marlins as special advisors. Look, this one is always funny because people actually somehow get angry that a figurehead position that was here to advise the ex-president, who's not here anymore, was somehow dismissed. To me, I don't know. To me, it doesn't make sense getting angry over that. It doesn't. How does it make sense to have the special advisor, which for what it's worth, clearly advised wrong time and time again, to David Sampson, be retained in the same position to a complete new regime? That doesn't make sense. So those that get upset with that, tissues. But they definitely could have been transitioned and dealt with better. They could have been more transparent about the plans, very similar in a very different severity to how they could have made Yelich buy in. They could have tried to have these very important figureheads of the Marlins community buy in a little bit more. Now, look, did they amend things with Jeff Conine? Absolutely. But there are some that didn't, whether it's Dawson, whether it's McKeon, whatever the case is. I feel like there was too much of a we're changing everything from Loria and we want it to be entirely wiped clean. And they went too far. I think they should have had a little bit more nuance and insight in here and said, well, there's some things that maybe don't need to change. Like, you know, Jack, I'm sorry, you don't have to be my special advisor the way that you were for Sampson, but let's find you something you're comfortable in the organization. Conine, Mr. Marlin, same for you. Dawson, let's do it. That is something that I think should have been handled much better. Another example of this is the Project Wolverine joke, okay, which has been heavily disputed and outdated time and time again, but somehow still gets used as gold standard to, you know, counter anything positive about the finances of this team. Even in that Myth article, when I brought up the finances, reported by Forbes, not even by me, by Forbes and other individuals, yeah, one of the comments is, oh, but Project Wolverine, they're just trying to cut slash payroll. And that, okay, great. You know, if Jeter isn't allowed, he's the only CEO in all of America to not be able to have a salary. That's the other one. Oh, he makes $5 million. I'm sorry. How much does your CEO make? It's ridiculous. Any CEO anywhere is allowed to make a salary. And quite frankly, for all the anger, and I broke my own rule of not talking about Jeter because he's a lightning post. I get it. I like to usually just say Bruce Sherman or the Marlins. I broke my own rule. For all the hate that he's gotten, he's done what he said that he was going to do. Once he became a little bit more transparent, he said, we're going to get this farm system in top shape. We're going to be active in the international market. We're going to focus on the pitching. Oh, voila, all three of those have happened. So you know what? Let the man earn his salary the way that every other CEO does. 10. And the last thing that I would do differently in this rebuild thus far is I would have already had Brian Anderson signed on here for the next 5 to 6 years. Now, listen, he has to go through arbitration. There's still team control. So I'm not saying he's going anywhere anytime soon. But I would have already had Brian Anderson signed for the next 5 to 6 to 7 years. Now, do I believe, listen to this very carefully, do I believe that they discuss extensions this year and that it likely gets done this offseason? Yes, I am telling you that right now. That is my belief from individuals that I've spoken with. I believe that that is something that will happen this offseason. If I'm wrong, that's unfortunate. But I really, truly believe that Brian Anderson is, which is why I wrote the Brian Anderson should be extended article. And it's why I've said it on air before. I believe that he should be extended, if not already, which is why I'm saying that it's something I would have done differently, then it's definitely something that has to happen. So we could kind of look at this last one as, okay, it's currently okay that he's not actually extended, but it'll be a soon-to-be regret if it doesn't happen. He needs an extension. Time is clicking before it gets to the point where it's no longer a team-friendly one either. So let's get it done. Let's get it moving. 1 through 10. Those are the 10 things that I would do differently and I would have done differently in this rebuild. Some which I called while it was happening, some which I was on the wrong side of it while it was happening, and some which I waited to make an assessment. Let me know your thoughts. Send me an email. Send me a tweet on Twitter at DannyM_MIA. Let me know what you think. Now, we have a few minutes left. Let's get to the pitching performance of the week and the hitter of the week. Pitching performance of the week, our all-star over here has decided to kind of pitch like an all-star the last two outings. He has had two very good back-to-back games. Of course, I'm talking about Sandy Alcantara. In his last one, he went seven innings pitch. He only allowed two runs on three hit ball. Now, something with Sandy we have to continue discussing is that he simply is not missing enough bats. And he only allowed three hits because he typically he's one of the best at having a low hard hit percentage. Individuals do not score the ball off of him because he has velo and he has a lot of movement. So he induces a lot of weak contact, but he's also not missing enough bats entirely. Only two strikeouts over seven innings is not something that is sustainable, is not something that typically leads to two earned runs, but a very good outing from him. Caleb Smith also had a good outing. Two of the baby-faced aces. Caleb's a little older, but he's still young at heart. Five innings pitch, one earned run, one hit. So one hit over five innings. Here's the change, though. Seven Ks. Now, two entirely different pitchers. We're talking about a righty and a lefty. We're talking about a velo guy versus a movement and control guy. One pitches a little bit better than the other one throws. But the hope is that with age, Sandy is 3-4 years younger than Caleb, he also starts learning how to pitch a little bit more effectively. I was having this conversation with Danny Rodriguez. He's someone on Marlins Twitter I love conversing baseball with. He's an active baseball player at the moment. I think the thing with Sandy is that his movement is so much. He has so much movement on his pitches that he doesn't quite nip the corners yet. So it's almost like a hitter can go up there and say, if I can identify that that's not a fastball, I'm going to spit on it, which means I'm not going to swing. If I see it's a slider off of his hand, I'm not swinging because it's not going to end up in the strike zone and it's not close enough to get the ump to bring me up. That's something that Caleb Smith has mastered. Caleb Smith's secondaries, you can't spit on it because he will bring you up looking. It's a good comparison here of what Sandy can be, even though we're talking about entirely different prospect, or not prospect, but pitching profiles. You don't always have to compare a very particular type of pitcher to the same type of pitcher. No, you can learn something from someone who throws from the opposite side of the mound and who has entirely different stuff. Caleb Smith can rack up 7 Ks in 5 innings because no one can spit on any of his pitches when they're in the box. He has to respect the secondaries and the fastball. The hope is that eventually Sandy then becomes more of a pitcher than just a thrower. Because at the end of the day, he continues to show those flashes that we saw in the first half. Now, for this week, if you ask me to choose one, I'm going to go with Smith. I'm going to go with Caleb because when you give me 5 innings pitch, and he likely could have gone to 6, maybe even a 7th, with 7 Ks only allowing one hit, you deserve the recognition. But with that being said, it's still nice to see Sandy showing what he can be at a very young age. And through the inconsistencies that we're going to see at a young age with a young pitcher who's developing, it's nice to see him put back-to-back quality starts. As for the hitter of the week, we have three candidates that have been candidates quite often in my recordings because, well, they're the best hitters or some of the best hitters on the team. Garrett Cooper this week went 368, has gone on base 45% of the time, slugging 579, OPS over 1,000, 7 hits, 1 double, 1 homer, 3 walks, and that's before whatever he does Sunday against the Rockies. Brian Anderson, extend the man, hit 320, got on base 34% of the time, slugging 480, 826 OPS, 8 hits with half of them. That would be 4 doubles. All he does is hit homers and doubles, homers and doubles. He is the extra base hit king at the moment for the Fish.
Anderson, left center field, and Garlick is not going to make the play. It's over his head. Birdie around third. Diaz right behind him. Seager's throw. Not in time. A 2-RBI double for Brian Anderson, and the Marlins open up a 4-1 lead.
We continue to talk about the progression of BA this season, and he continues to get it done.
And he is someone that needs to be extended. I will continue to be the conductor on that train. I will write articles. I will talk about it on air. Brian Anderson needs to be extended. I think it happens this offseason. And the third candidate is someone that we really needed to see have a bounce back week. Alfaro had a very good first half for the Marlins, at least when we have the parameters of the fact that he was traded with JT Realmuto leaving, the fact that he's young, the part of his developmental process that he is in. When we consider all of those variables, his first half production was solid. He showed us power. Yes, he struck out quite a lot and he doesn't walk enough. That's part of his profile, but the power was there. And then the second half has just been bad. He has been K-ing at a 40% rate. He's been hitting below the Mendoza line. The power is simply not there right now. He's also had a little bit of tough luck with some hard hit outs, but he has simply not been making enough contact until this week. This week, he hit over 300. He got on base 35% of the time. His slugging is nearing 400. OPS 718, six hits, one double. He is starting to have more complete at bats. It's what we need to see from him. Listen, at the end of the day, if George Alfaro, with the addition of the immense batting hitting talent that the farm system now has, if George Alfaro is your seventh or eighth hitter in your lineup, he's one of the best seventh or eighth hitters in baseball. He's someone with significant power. He's a good framer behind for his pitchers. He's a good leader, I've been told, for his pitchers. He has good rapport with them and with the staff. He's someone you want on your team. If he's striking out 40% of the time, he might not be on the team. So that's something to monitor, but I really do believe that if you made me choose who I feel the real George Alfaro is, George Alfaro, please stand up the first half or the second half, I'm going to go with first half George Alfaro. And it's nice to see him starting to come out of it again, hitting over 300, 35% on base, almost 400 slugging, six hits over this last week. We'll see what he does Sunday against the Rockies. My belief is truly that George Alfaro is going to be a fixture, and it's nice to see these three in a week full of losing, okay? But they went up against the Braves, the Dodgers, and then they had to go to Coors. I mean, come on. In a week full of losing, it's nice to see that the five players that have stood up a bit are all core fixtures. Sandy Alcantara, Caleb Smith, Garrett Cooper, Brian Anderson, and George Alfaro. They've also been getting help from the John Birdies of the world, from the Starlin Castros of the world. So it's nice to see even Grandy Man has put some nice offensive value this week. But most complete overall, these three. Now you choose who you want to select for it. But it's nice to have that Cooper Anderson Alfaro trio back. All right, everyone. I hope you really enjoyed the myths, top 10 myths today. I hope you enjoyed the second conversation piece, looking at the 10 things that I would have done differently. I always thank you for listening. And like I started off in the beginning of the show, I'll end it. It's because I really appreciate it. I'm really genuine when it comes to this, man. I love doing this. This is a labor of love. I love the fan base. I love the city. I love the organization. And I'm thankful for you. I'm thankful that you're listening. I'm thankful that you care to listen and you're a part of the conversation. And to those that reach out, I am thankful for every single email and every single tweet. Here at Fish Stripes, we really do appreciate the fans. Make sure you leave a review. Make sure you like. Make sure you subscribe wherever podcasts are found. Reach out to me. Like I said, I'm on Twitter at DannyM_MIA. I have my email available on fishstripes.com. I want the engagement. You guys have done an amazing job of doing that. Let's keep the train rolling. Go fish.